Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and we are here for another episode of The Sound of Economics Live. This time, we will provide some reflections in connection with the European Council, which on 15 and 16 of October has on the agenda the implementation of the UK withdrawal agreement and review the state of the negotiations on the future EU-UK partnership. I'm pleased to welcome Guntram Wolf, the director of Bruegel, deputy director Maria De Mertzis, and Bruegel senior scholar André Sapir. Hello, André, Maria, Guntram. How are you?
Good, good.
Hello. Hello, everybody.
So I'm also happy that our listeners can join our conversation by asking questions on Slido.do using the hashtag EU-UK. So to start up, we just ran a poll on Twitter with our followers, and we asked what do they think is the most likely Brexit conclusion of the upcoming European Council summit. And unsurprisingly, the results were quite close, with around 54% saying that there will be a ramp up of no-deal plans and around 46% for an extension of talks. So before starting our discussion, let me recap where do we stand as of today, 13 of October, as the situation regarding the issue is very fluid and changing by the hour. So after 9 rounds of negotiations between the EU and the UK, there remains a stalemate between the two sides on two key issues: state aid rules, the so-called level playing field, and fisheries. Then the EU sees agreement on these two issues as a prerequisite for an overall deal which has halted progress in more immediate areas such as financial services. Also, time is running out. With the transition period coming to an end on December 31st, any agreement would realistically need to be struck this week in order to be ratified by UK and EU parliaments in time. So talks have increased, moving to a restricted format with fewer officials from both sides in the past week, and there are some signs of compromise, but you know, the situation, as I said, is very, very fluid. And all this must be placed in the context of what has been going on in the past few weeks, including passage of the UK Internal Market Bill, giving powers to the UK ministers to circumvent the Northern Ireland Protocol in certain circumstances, drew condemnation across the EU and part of the UK, with critics claiming that trust has now been seriously damaged between the two sides. Now, we are clearly seeing a lot of questions around the specifics of the single issues, such as fisheries, negotiating tactics, and contingency plans. However, I believe that it would be useful for us and for our listeners to take a few steps back and start our reflection on broader aspects of the situation we are in now. So I would like to start with Guntram.
Thank you very much, Giuseppe. It's a real pleasure to actually be in the office today and be in our studio and actually have a headset and a real microphone and talk to you today about Brexit and see some of you in person. As you said, it's a very charged week, and I think in such a week, it's probably useful to have a quick look back, and then you know, look at some of the broad key issues that will have to be discussed in this week, but perhaps also in the coming weeks. I mean, we are entering now the so-called negotiating tunnel, so it's the last weeks during which you know, a deal needs to be struck. But I think before we talk about the tunnel, let's talk a bit about where we come from. And we really come from a moment more than 4.5 years, almost 4.5 years ago, when the United Kingdom had a referendum, and the referendum was to leave the EU. There was then later on a notification, and the EU did not negotiate with the UK before the UK notified the EU formally of its intention to leave. And since then, there have been lots of negotiations ongoing. And of course, the UK has left the EU as of the end of January of this year. So we are now in the transition period, and this transition period will run its due course by the end of this year, meaning as of next year, the relationship in trade in all matters with the UK is, as of now, still undefined. And if there's no deal struck in trade matters, it will be a WTO-based World Trade Organization-based trade relationship. I think looking back at the bigger picture, it is fair to say that the EU has so far been quite rapid and very united in its response to the United Kingdom leaving the EU. And I think it really, Michel Barnier, the chief negotiator, trade negotiator for the chief negotiator for the EU, deserves credit for the unitedness of the EU. So the EU has been united, also in thanks to Michel Barnier, who really managed to bring people together, bring all the member states together, and define a united front. The question really is, and here I'm borrowing a bit from Brigitte Lafan, the director of the Robert Schuman Center in Florence, who coined the phrase united, so rapid, united, and effective. The question really is whether the EU is effective. And I think this is really what is at stake. And I would argue here that a failure to agree a deal, especially if we fail to agree on a deal over fishery rights, will mean that we have not been effective. And that means we as the EU have not been effective, and we as the negotiators, meaning also the UK, has not been effective. This is about reaching a trade negotiation and coming to a conclusion here. If we don't achieve it, I think history will not look kind at the key people involved in these negotiations. So really, I think this week is very important, because the European Council meets. The heads of state have time to look back and really also look at the issues at stake, look at the fishery issues, look at the trade issues, look at the level playing field issues, and really try to reassess where the balance is, because ultimately now it's about finding the right balance between market access on the one hand and on the other hand, of course, ensuring the level playing field. And I think that's really at stake. And I would really hope that after 4.5 years, this can come to a good end, because I'm sure history books will say the EU also failed if we don't reach a deal.
André, what is your broader vision?
Let me just follow on Guntram on the broader picture, but let me start from a different angle. I will put first my trade hat, and when I look in the relationship, which is obviously a much more complex than only a trade relationship, but after all, what is being negotiated at the moment is mainly a trade agreement with a number of other elements. But at the core, this is a trade negotiation. Now, if you look from a trade perspective, I think what strikes me very, very, very much, and I think is at the heart of this discussion, is the importance of the trade relationship from both sides. For the UK, it has been repeated many, many times, and rightly so, that the EU is the number one partner of the UK, and accounting for roughly 50% of UK's trade. And that's obviously a huge share. And, you know, geography is there. The biggest market close to the UK is obviously the European Union. Now, if you look from the perspective of the European Union, the UK is a very important partner as well. It's not the number one partner, as it is for the UK. You know, the EU is the number one partner for the UK. The UK is not the number one partner of the EU, but it is the number two partner. So that's still very, very large. Behind the United States, but ahead of China. So, you know, the fact that the UK ranks there between the US and China in terms of partnership of trade vis-a-vis the EU does show that it is a very, very large partner. Now, obviously, it's more important for some EU countries than for others. And that is obviously playing a role in the dynamics inside the European Union. And I very much agree with Guntram that Michel Barnier has managed the negotiation inside the EU beautifully. I mean, it was not given that having 27 countries with different interests in their relationship to the UK would manage all the way to have a close and united united front. So that has been there. But as I said, the UK is an important partner for the EU, just like the EU is an important partner for the UK. And that's the reason why, from the start of the more modest negotiation on trade, I've been very optimistic that a deal will be struck. I don't think a deal will be struck this week, but I think a deal will be struck before midnight in time for the ratification and the implementation of the deal as of January the 1st of next year. A second factor that I want to bring in on the bigger picture, and which I have observed and I think which has been very important, is that I think the UK has not handled very well the UK-Irish relationship. And I think that's on the politics. It's obviously a very important economic relationship, but it's also a very important political relationship. And we have seen all along, and especially in the recent weeks, that the UK-Irish relationship as having up and down all the time, and you know the UK bringing at the very last moment this new bill, which has annoyed everybody on the European side. So I think what has happened is that Ireland, a small country in the EU, obviously very big in the relationship with the UK, has managed very successfully to have the other countries rally behind it, to protect it. In a sense, it has shown that this issue of solidarity, which is always being put forward in the EU, has worked beautifully well in the case of Ireland. You know, Ireland has, in a sense, appealed to the other EU countries that, look, I'm the small guy vis-a-vis the UK. I need the help of the EU. I need to have the EU united so that Ireland will not be exposed as the weak partner in the relationship with the UK. And I think that has worked very, very well. And I think that the UK has underestimated that. So I think, you know, from an economic viewpoint, from a political viewpoint, I think now it's time to come to everybody's senses and make an agreement. But I think this is the bigger picture as far as I'm concerned in sort of this trade negotiation.
Thank you, André. What is the bigger picture for Maria?
For the sake of just arguing a little bit more color in the sense of not necessarily totally agreeing with everything you said, although both of our speakers have said. What I find remarkable, and here we are on the 13th of October, 4 years later, almost more than that, actually. And I find it remarkable that even though, as André has said, our incentives are aligned, economic incentives, but I would dare say even beyond economic incentives, they're all aligned. And we still haven't managed to basically write it down on paper. I find that rather remarkable. I mean, I would have thought as soon as we had the withdrawal agreement out of the way, because there the incentives weren't necessarily aligned. I could imagine the UK trying to want to pay less, whereas the EU will try to persuade the UK to pay more. There I could buy the idea that incentives were not totally aligned. But when it comes to the future relationships, you know, to how we're going to interact with each other as, you know, as of January after that, you know, the better we negotiate that deal, the better we both will do. There isn't a trade-off here. And yet we haven't managed to do that. I find that remarkable. And you know, in any negotiations, there are two parties here. There is a lot that, in my view, has gone wrong in the UK, primarily on the political side. And it fits, in my view, with a much broader political atmosphere in the global scene, which makes a lot of things unpredictable. And you know, when things are unpredictable, they can go in different directions, not all of them sensical. So we have gone into avenues that, in my view, have not necessarily been sensical. They have been mostly nonsensical. And therefore, it makes outcomes very unpredictable. So, you know, when this happens, the probability of accidents, namely in two months from now, we have no deal, is not insignificant. It can happen, and we shouldn't be here. We shouldn't be at the level where we having to contemplate accidents happening in significant probabilities. It should have been a lot easier to get to this. And there are two parties here. One is the UK that has got all these problems and has got a lot to lose. On the other side, you have the EU, which has been equally remarkably united and consistent. But that has also made the EU intransigent, at least from the perspective of the UK. And you know, the question is this necessarily a good thing, or is it simply increasing the probability of no outcome? And if it is increasing the probability of a no outcome, I think the EU also needs to consider what a EU member leaving actually means. In terms of, you know, gaining back control, if I may use this expression. So, I would like to be as optimistic as Andreas. I think at the end of the day, I sense should prevail. We both have a lot to lose and we shouldn't. But I fear that accidents are also likely along the way.
Thank you. Thank you, Maria. I would like to ask Guntram any kind of follow-up remark. Do you agree with Maria and André?
How likely it is that we get a deal, I think, is still unresolved. And I think Maria is right that accidents can happen. And the fishery issue is certainly an issue that is quite difficult to deal with, right? And I think on the fisheries, if I can say that one word, on the fisheries, the UK's position is essentially, we are leaving the EU, and isn't it you, the UK, the EU, that have always told us that leaving has consequences? Well, here you go. We leave. So our fishery waters are our waters. Why do you want to continue to have the same access as before? So that's the UK position. And I think from that point of view, I understand that position. And I really think the EU, has to find a way of dealing with this. And you know, I think it would be wrong from an EU point of view to take this fishery point as the only red line. I mean, there have been so many. The consequences of not having a trade deal because of fisheries is quite significant. I mean, there's not only a few artisanal fishers in Bretagne that will be affected. I mean, there will be tens of thousands firms across the continent that do daily business with the UK that would be affected if there is no deal. So why would we want to sort of prioritize the fishing over, you know, the multitude of interests in all the other in all the other sectors? So it really seems to me fine if that is a tactic of negotiation. But not fine if it is a real red line. I mean, we cannot accept that sort of individually driven red lines also on the EU side prevent us from striking a deal, which is really, as I think André and we all have pointed out, is in the overall interest of both sides.
Guntram, I would pretty much agree with you that if it's a tactique for the negotiation table, I think this is what we retain out of this reflection. If it's a tactique, it's okay. But if it's one of the big red lines, then we have a problem. On the other element that there is on the table, which is quite specific, which is state aid, I would like to zoom in a little bit because it seems to me that it's a little bit more, it's a broader issue than a potential red line tactique negotiating card. It seems to me a broader issue that can affect, you know, things like competition policy, trade, and you name it. So I would like to ask, we start in a different order this time. I would like to ask Maria to get her view and zoom in a little bit this issue of state aid, and then hear also the rest of you.
So let me go back one step. I think there are three sticking points still with various degrees of progress in all three of them. One is fisheries. The other one is state aid, but it's also the governance issue, you know, so the dispute settlement. When we are in that next world of the UK effectively out, and there are disputes, who will govern this, I think. And that had been with us for a rather long time and is still not resolved, even though I think there is more progress made on that point than on the other two. Now, and as you said, Giuseppe, it really is a package. It's a package that we need to see. And here I really agree with Guntram's analysis on the fisheries. It makes no sense, in my view, to spend all your gunpowder, your dry gunpowder, to an issue that is economically not the most important one. I think you need, if you're trying to preserve the welfare of the EU in your tactics, then you need to understand what is the biggest point in terms of affecting welfare if it were to go wrong. And there I really agree that it is other things that are more important. And the state aid, as you say, Giuseppe, is then what comes to mind. The state aid is effectively what we now call in economics as the level playing field, whether there's going to be the UK is going to abuse its position and effectively subsidize its own companies. And here I think the financial markets is perhaps the most important sector we care about, and give them what we would consider an unfair advantage. Okay, now, you know, that could potentially be a big issue, because if it were to affect the financial sector, the UK already starts from a point of advantage when it comes to the financial sector. If it were to promote that in what we would consider in Europe unfair, in an unfair way, then that is really going to reinforce its position to the detriment of the EU's position. So this is the one, this is the problem to solve. Now, when it comes to tactics, you said, Giuseppe, if it is just tactics, that's okay. Well, I am not entirely sure I agree with that. I mean, because the probability of causing an accident as a result of following quite unnerving tactics increases. And, you know, we are really 5 minutes before the hour. And by the end of next week, we're going to be 1 minute before the hour, because certain things need to come through ratification. You know, really, are we really at this position now to basically play a game? Is this what we are can afford to do? So I think it's important to go back and understand what really is the economic significance of the three things, economic and otherwise significance of the three things. They are still sticking points, and argue them accordingly. I just don't see that we have enough time, any more time. And as it is, I think we spend a lot of time trying to achieve something that should have been obvious, in my view.
Thank you, Maria. André, what do you think about this?
Let me take again the more optimistic view on this. The first thing I would say, which I find extremely reassuring, is that we are discussing, and Maria is very right to have put forward the three sticking issues, right? It's state aid, fisheries, and the governance or the enforcement mechanism. Now, those were exactly what the same three issues that we were talking about more than a year ago. So I think this is very good. Those three issues were not hiding behind them, a whole series of other issues that once one would have solved those three issues, we would have seen, hey, wait a second, you know, those are rather small issues compared to some much bigger issue that is lurking behind and is going to really make this negotiation very hard. No, the three issues were very clear from the start and they're still there with us. I find that very reassuring from a negotiating viewpoint. You know, there's not some, yes, sure, there was this Irish point recently made in the UK. That was like a bomb. Suddenly, you know, where is this coming from? You know, how are we going to handle that? And is this going to derail the whole negotiation? And it nearly did. And then I think, you know, people calmed down a little bit and said, you know, no, let's go back to the real negotiation on those three points. But I'm very reassured that, you know, we are still talking of those issues and we know already for more than a year what are the contours of a negotiation on and of a deal on this. Personally, I'm not frightened at all. And I can tell you that I have told that to a number of people involved in this negotiation. I'm not frightened at all by the fisheries. I think fisheries is also very much the essence of a deal, you know, because the British have, sure, they're recuperating sovereignty about British water, and that's for sure. At the same time, to the extent that fish is being fished out of the UK, it has to be sold someplace. And this fish is not going to be sold in the UK, as we know. This fish, which is fished in British water, is eaten on all plates in the EU27. So again, there's very much sort of the normal essence of a deal here. You know, they have the fish and we want to consume the fish. And that is true for many, many other things. And it goes in the other way around. Sometimes we have the stuff and they want to consume it. And that's great. You put it on the table. It's, yes, sure, a trade negotiation. There's the issue about fishermen and that needs to be dealt with. And that is. But that's what trade negotiators know how to do. They have huge experience about this. So I'm not worried about this. Sure, there's some hoopla and there's some politics, but this is the bread and butter of a trade negotiation. What about the state aid? The state aid could potentially be something much deeper here. But are we really worried that the British, with their history, are going to turn into a subsidizing country much more than we are? I don't see that at all either. So yes, there is an issue which I think we have now gone beyond as to whether the UK has to abide by the EU state aid rules. After they leave the EU, you know, they still have to abide by the EU state aid rules. No, that is a political problem. This is going back sort of to the notion of why Brexit, why sovereignty? And that definitely cannot work. The UK cannot accept that although they are no more in the single market, they still have to abide by exactly the same rule as before. No, it's fine if those rules on the content are the same as today, but they are not called the EU rules. So that the EU and the UK agree on a set of rules on state aid that mimic what we have today, but it's not saying that we in the UK, we have to follow the EU rules. That is what the problem is. But the UK and the EU agreeing on a new set of rules that happen, by the way, to be exactly the same rules, that I think is much less of a problem. And then remains the issue of the enforcement. And I think the enforcement is, again, one of those matters that are important from a symbolic viewpoint. You know, cannot be the European Court of Justice, needs to be something else. And something else that we can trust each other. They can trust us and we can trust them. And there, I think, is a real matter. And so, in the end, this agreement cannot come to fruition if there is not a minimum amount of trust. And trust is really the essence. Trust based on interests. So this is what they need to really, to me, the last mile is that. Is the interest is obvious. Do we have enough trust? Not trust, you know, to be married again, but trust to have a good relationship outside of marriage. And that's what we need to prove to one another. The two sides need to prove that you know they are going to behave in a fair manner, respecting rules that they will agree upon.
Guntram, do you agree? Are you optimistic as well?
Well, let me take a bit the contrarian view to André here. I think it sounds almost a little bit too good to be true, to be quite honest. And let me sort of walk you through three critical points. I think the first, again, and I start again with fish, even though the fish is really, I think, the least important. But still, I mean, it's not insignificant. And so quickly on the fish, I mean, I think so far there has been very, very little management of the political reality of French and Belgian fleets having less access to British waters as of January 21. I mean, this is regionally, and politics is always local. It is going to be an issue, and I think when striking a deal, which I think will involve less access than currently to British waters, you know, one will have to find a way of compensating the losers. Now, then one can lose next generation EU European money to sort of support the fishermen, but one has to actively manage this. I don't think one can just sort of without a face saving solution and an economic support for those regions go through on a deal with this. But like André, let me say the more important point is, of course, essentially the level playing field issue. And there, it seems to me, really the deal needs to strike is a balance between, on the one hand, access to market, and on the other hand, control and ability to ensure the level playing field remains in place. I think this is really where the negotiation this week in the European Council will focus on also. I mean, it will really focus on is what is currently on the table in terms of access on services, meaning in particular, and access here means not just tariffs. I mean, the zero tariffs, I think that's in mutual interest, obviously. But really in services, it's much more about the sort of the non-tariff barriers, right? Regulatory barriers, recognition barriers. These issues, I mean, and that's becomes very technically, right? But I mean, it's very important because these issues matter to business on both sides. And so what one will have to investigate is whether the balance of what is on the table is appropriate and merits from a EU point of view, giving the access, and from a UK point of view, also giving the access, while at the same time, you know, ensuring the level playing field. So it's about finding the right balance between access to the market and ensuring the level playing field. As regards there is perhaps one more point on this level playing field, and there I quite agree with André. I mean, there is this myth in the EU that you know, the UK once out will become a rogue state and sort of massively subsidize and on top of it deregulate in environmental issues, for example, massively its economy. For example, Charles Michel said that, I think, in a recent speech. He was saying, the European Council president, he was saying, well, in environmental issues, the UK might be less strict than the EU. I mean, I think odds are high that it might be actually the opposite way, that in environmental issues, the UK is going to regulate tougher than the EU. So this is not just a one-way street. I think it's really a two-way street. And there, perhaps to end on that note, where I would disagree with André is this notion of trust. I mean, I think trust, no, I think we need enforceable rules. I mean, that's in the end what we need. We need enforcement capacity, and we need rules that you know, basically can be enforced. And there, again, it's clear it cannot be the European Court of Justice, but there will have to be a dispute settlement mechanism that is robust enough that both sides trust it, because one way or another there will be some sort of regulatory divergence in the future, and you know we will have to deal with that, and we will have to deal with that not based on sort of I trust that you know the future prime minister in the UK is going to behave nicely. No, that's not the way it works. I trust because I believe the UK is a country that respects international rules, and so I believe that the EU is a country, is an economy that respects international rules, and we have found a way, legislated a way of dealing and managing with this future divergence.
I would like to take some questions from the audience because we are some interesting ones. An anonymous person just wrote that the trade deal will cover only part of the overall economic relationship. How do you see the rest evolving? For example, equivalence, data adequacy, etc. I don't know who might want to pick it up.
Perhaps very quickly on the data flows. There has been some blog posts by our colleague Scott Marcus on data flows between the EU and the US, and he has also done some thinking on privacy issues around data flows with the UK. And the UK situation is quite similar after Brexit to that of the United States, meaning the UK is gonna fall one way or another under the jurisdiction of the Schrems case, which really put some limits to firms to transfer data to locations outside of the EU. And without a trade deal, without a deal, I think the deal will have to, be that a side deal or be part of the overall deal, will have to find some language and some arrangement on data transfers, because otherwise firms will not be able to transfer data out of the EU to the UK because of privacy and concerns.
I wanted to add is on the data. I mean, and this is in response to the listener. Now the kind of trade agreement that one is negotiating and that the EU has been negotiating already with a number of other partners, including recently with Japan, not just sort of Canada that is always being referred to. Those agreements go much beyond the narrow definition of trade. And it's very clear that when it comes to trade in services, for instance, and digital services, the data is very much an important component. So yes, those modern trade agreements, they do include elements like data, the flow of data, in as far as that it does obviously relate to the sort of modern trade flows in particular in services. So so this trade deal with the UK is a trade deal which is a broad trade deal, not a narrow trade deal, simply dealing with tariffs or even sort of the traditional non-tariff barriers. It does include all of those questions, including the climate, including the data. Now, this data is a difficult issue indeed, because it gets into privacy and sometimes it can get into even security issues, right? Terrorism, I mean, all of those matters, and each country has their own tradition about that. So, but again, I think that with the UK, which is a like-minded country, I think it is possible to make an arrangement. So again, This is feasible. Whether this will be part of the deal, of the trade deal that will be signed, hopefully before the end of the year or not, that's a different matter, right? Some of those matters are very complicated, and I can imagine that this will be, as it is the case indeed with other countries, that this will be an evolving trade deal. That there is a trade deal that solves a number of issues. And then there are still some outstanding points, and data could be one of them. But I think eventually, assuming that we have a trade deal before the end of the year, either it will include data or data will be added at a later date.
Thank you, André. Maria, you would like to add something, right?
I mean, just on this point, I think defense is also a very important issue that we don't hear a lot about. We did at the beginning when Mrs. May was still the prime minister, and it was all in good faith, but we need to see how this will evolve. And I think from the point of view of the EU, this is going to be an important thing to try and secure, or at least encourage. But I wanted to come back to this wonderful discussion that both Guntram and André had earlier on, and about... you know, effectively, the UK, and I certainly agree with both of you, is not a rogue country and is not about to become one. I think that is, I have no worries about that. There are, however, two issues that I think put the position of the UK somewhere in a different than what it was up till now as a member of the EU. The first one is that it's not a member of the EU anymore. If you believe, like I do, that leaving the EU is a bad thing in economic terms, then the UK will necessarily do worse as a result of being alone. And there are many ways we can justify that. But personally, I believe that economically speaking, the UK will necessarily lose as a result of not being the EU. And dare I say, irrespective of the deal that it cuts out with the EU, because it will necessarily be worse than what it had as a member of the EU. So now the UK is looking for ways to regain some of the disadvantages that it will eventually see ahead of it. The UK doesn't see leaving the EU as a disadvantage. That's why it chose to left. But in my view, it will necessarily lose out of not being a member of the EU, and therefore it needs to reinvent itself. Economically speaking, and how will it reinvent itself is anybody's guess. But I think some of the elements of the state aid will have to play in. Again, I don't believe the UK is going to be this regulating state, a state that is going to try and have unfair disadvantages. But the direction of travel will necessarily have to include some of that, because it will need to get advantages where it can. So that's one thing. And I don't necessarily think this is a bad thing. But I mean, from the point of view of the EU, we need to be vigilant. And the EU is very right, in my view, to try and get this one right, at least the state aid. The other thing is this thing that just happened just a few weeks ago on the attempt to pass the Single Act on basically not respecting previous agreements. You know, if symbolism is important, and I think André made this point, this is a very symbolic thing, precisely because you don't expect something of that from the UK. And when the UK makes that, it raises a lot of alarm bells in my view. So the symbolism damage that this has done, in my view, is important, is significant. And it tells us something about what can happen in the future. So there I think, and here I'm in total agreement with what Guntram said. I mean, the governance issue needs to be watertight. It cannot be on a gentleman's agreement. It has to be watertight so that we can have something to fall back on if or when things unravel.
I think that what you are pointing out also broadens it up the scope of... start to think the UK as a third country and start to think about the geopolitical consequences of it on the global scenarios as well, and how the global scenarios are influencing in a way or another what is going to happen and what will happen afterwards. And I'm saying that this also because we received another question from another listener who was indeed pointing out or asking what and how the outcome of the US election will affect the future of the EU-UK trade relationship, which I guess it's one of these other very huge questions that we don't have a crystal ball to look into it and we can't really. But where the question, I think, resonates, at least to me, is to think a little bit broader about the UK, like now that it's going to completely go out of the gravitational orbit of the EU, what is going to happen? And there are also other questions, not only about the US, but also about China, and how this will play out. So broadening up the question from our listener, maybe we can have some comments about it.
Yes. Well, I guess my first point is the UK is not leaving the gravitational pull of the EU. I mean, no matter what happens, a country like the UK will always have to relate to Europe, and it always related to Europe over centuries, and that won't change. I think that's the first reality we have to accept. I mean, geography is what it is, and so we will have to relate to each other, no matter what happens. Now, the UK, the US election is of course a big thing. It matters hugely for many reasons. I think the future of democracy and perhaps even the Western world is really at stake, in my view. I think coming to the UK issue specifically, I think one thing is very clear. Joe Biden has already made very clear that the Good Friday Agreement and respecting essentially the withdrawal agreement, so to make sure that the situation in Ireland doesn't escalate, is an absolute necessity. And I think that's very, very important. I'm not sure Donald Trump, if he was elected, would care particularly about this. And, he would probably be ready to strike a sort of trade deals and alliances with the UK anyway, even if the situation in Ireland escalates. But I think that would certainly be different for the Democrats. But I guess on a broader picture, as I said, I think the UK and, the European nations and the EU as a whole will always have to relate to each other. And I think on the broad scale, on many, many issues, ultimately our interests are quite closely aligned, it seems to me. I think we can also see now how discussions on, let's say, the relation towards China, how the UK has toughened a bit its position and the EU has also toughened its position. I mean, so I think, of course, we are not at every moment sort of in the same sort of balance, exact balance. But I think on the broad picture, if you look at it again from the history books, I think you will see that in many dimensions, be that Russia, be that China, but also be it the US, we are on many respects, we really have shared interests.
Thank you, Guntram. André, do you want to add something about this specific aspect of the geopolitical global interest and also value of what is going on? Because we are also now looking quite into this deal as an internal affairs, but how the rest of the world is actually looking into what is going on at the moment, how they are looking at the EU and the UK. That's also an interesting element or perspective out of this.
That is right. So I would say make several points. Number one, I think that the Trump presidency, which has happened at the same time as the Brexit discussion, has, I think, helped the EU, the EU 27, to have a common position. As I said before, and I agreed there with Guntram, we started to say that Barnier has done a very good job at managing to keep cohesion on the part of the 27 when it was not a given at the start, since they were potentially different interests and even different philosophies that could have animated the 27 countries. And I think that the Trump presidency and what it has done to geopolitics has had an impact of cohesion among the EU countries. I think it has played that same role, in fact, this year in a completely different file when it came to the recovery program, the agreement in July among the EU countries, which was also not an obvious, you know, that the countries would agree on sort of such a novel and large package of mutual help inside the EU, I think came into the same view that, you know, we are living in a much tougher world now, of which obviously Trump has contributed a lot in making this world a much, you know, with much greater amount of uncertainty. And I think that has helped the EU country to coalesce, to feel that, you know, we need to stick together in those difficult times. And so I think that was there. Will suddenly now the Biden presidency change matters? You know, where the EU said that, no, we are relaxed, we are again in an easy world, and therefore, you know, we are going to not be united anymore into the negotiation with the UK. Obviously, that's not the case. It's too late. It's too late for that. So I think that a change of presidency in the US will have a lot of impact on global relation, on geopolitics, and on discussion between the EU and the UK and other countries in fora, you know, trying to bring back sort of more multilateralism. And I think it will be incumbent upon the UK to show that indeed the UK is committed, like the EU, to repairing multilateral relations. And this is not given. You know, some people feel that, you know, we cannot go back in history, that the damage that has been done by the Trump presidency cannot be repaired. And I think that repairing is important, but it's not going to be obvious. And I think it would be very important to see exactly where the UK fits into that conversation.
Maria, we are also approaching towards the end of this episode, so I want to have you a little bit as a bridge between these last questions. We have many other questions from the listeners, but unfortunately the time is not infinite for us. So a little bit of a bridge and also some starting of last conclusions before I ask also Guntram to conclude with few words and then thanking everyone. Thank you.
It is true that the UK has always had a special relationship with the US, but I think it's a lot more special to the UK than it is to the US. So I think the UK uses that in ways that the US doesn't always understand. And so I actually agree with Andres' point that to the extent that you will see a difference in the relationship or our ability of the EU and the UK to achieve a different relationship as a result of the US elections, it will be because it will affect the world and therefore it will also affect our ability to reach a better or worse agreement. I don't think it will be directly an impact on just the UK. I think the multilateral is the big thing, and the extent that the next US administration plays this multilateral card will affect the ability of the world to come into better agreements. So maybe a final thought on, and I don't know what direction you're going with your final question, but I mean, I suppose a little bit of what we think will happen is kind of an obvious one. You know, I am going to stick with Andre here, and I'm going to want to share his optimism simply because it's the right thing to do. The EU operates like that. Always in the 11th hour, we have an agreement. You know, a few of us lose nights as a result of that. And as a Greek, I can contest to that. But we always get there, and I think we will get there this time too. I don't think it will be an easy ride, but I'm hopeful that we will be able to come to sort of a good basis to build a better sort of a cooperative agreement in the future.
Thank you, Maria. And the final words to Guntram, of course, and what is your wish? What is your future direction? And what should we expect for the next week, but also the next month and the next year?
I think a lot of analysts are always coming with this number, right? So now the probability of a deal is 55%, then a day later it's 65%, and then it's 27%. So I think these numbers, of course, are pretty meaningless. I think what is clear is the coming weeks are really sort of ending a story that started 4.5 years ago. And I think it is really in the next 3, 4, 5 weeks that all the decisive final decisions will have to be taken. Or I don't believe a minute that one will circumvent the rules and sort of extend even further. I think now we are coming really to an end of this saga, and so it is the next weeks where the negotiations are happening, and you know, where in the tunnel everybody has to find a way to agree, and if we don't, we don't. So who knows?
Thank you, Guntram. I would like to thank all of you for listening to this episode of The Sound of Economics live, and I would like to invite you as well to visit our webpage www.bruegel.org, where there is a lot of insights and research from our scholars on the topic of Brexit since many years, of course, because as we have also mentioned in our title, this is something that is accompanying us since a while, and will probably accompany us for a little while more. So there will be other occasions to discuss this together with The Sound of Economics and with Bruegel. Thank you so much, and until next time, bye-bye.